You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Monday's signing into law of a hastily passed Homeland Security Act has aroused concern that the law's wide web of surveillance and enforcement could target political activists and ordinary citizens, along with its primary targets in the war against terrorism. Robert Knight from Pacifica Station WBAI reports from New York.
Among the law's provisions is the creation of a so-called Homeland Security Advanced Research Projects Agency, which many fear would be a spin-off of the Total Information Awareness Project, now headed by disgraced former Admiral John Poindexter at the Pentagon's Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. The Department of Defense project aims at creating a master database using credit and communications records, public documents, law enforcement reports, biometric photo surveillance, and other data to track presumed suspicious activities of American citizens. Several legislators who voted for the Homeland Security Act, including Senators Dianne Feinstein and Joseph Lieberman, now say they will seek legislation to prevent surveillance and privacy abuses with the Pentagon's Total Information Awareness Program and keep that separate from activities of the new Homeland Security Department. But First Amendment Foundation Director Kit Gage says the retroactive protections may be moot.
Well, the Congress, after a lot of immediate outcry from all around the country, put in a little amendment into Homeland Security saying that there would be no similar program within the Homeland Security Agency, but I'm not sure that helped us any, since if this program goes ahead in the Defense Department, presumably the information collected in that program gets used by folks within Homeland Security. So I think it's a completely useless protection.
Gage says the Homeland Security law is only the latest in a series of federal actions impinging on privacy and due process. Earlier this month, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court of Review removed the traditional separation between foreign intelligence and domestic criminal prosecution.
With that decision, Mr. Ashcroft said that basically the gloves are off, with intelligence and law enforcement all being told that they should share any and all information with the Poindexter program or similar kinds of programs that are presumably already up. There will be much greater sharing of vast kinds of information that the government's never had access to before, that it's going to share on people that it isn't accusing of a crime, that this will be one big fishing expedition against everybody in the United States and many people outside of it, in an effort to try to find patterns that the government finds suspicious. If you look at the history of what the government finds suspicious, often what it has found suspicious is activity in which people are engaged in First Amendment activity. They are dissenters. They are disagreeing with government policy, and that makes them suspicious.
Adding to the new glut of government information is access to communications records, including phone calls, email, and browsing records, as mandated by the Patriot Act and the Homeland Security Act. In addition, a recent Eighth Circuit court ruling allows easy government retrieval of communications records by faxed request rather than personal appearance by prosecutors, prompting this automated response from the Yahoo service provider.
Please address all subpoenas to the Yahoo custodian of records. We accept criminal subpoenas for the production of documents by fax.
Albert Ghadari represents some of the nation's major communications and internet carriers.
I think the law has made it clearer and easier for service providers to cooperate with law enforcement investigators. It has made it less difficult for a carrier to disclose information that they have and have come across in their normal operations and believe to be relevant to national security or intelligence issues, and this arises through a lot of different ways. The changes in the Homeland Security Act and the changes in the Patriot Act make it very clear that a volunteer, a service provider who volunteers information of an emergency nature, is completely protected under the law.
Ghadari says the volume of law enforcement requests to internet providers has increased dramatically in recent months.
Closer to exponential than linear. The subpoenas, again, these are anecdotal, taken from the multiple providers I work with, where I can measure what we did prior to September 11th and look at what we've done afterwards, and it's 4 or 5 times greater.
Despite the new extent of counterterrorist surveillance in the United States, the First Amendment Foundation's Kit Gage says that legitimate political activity should not succumb to the chilling effect of surveillance, and that the current legislation is ultimately reversible.
You know, activists always need to be concerned about government surveillance. But that said, it can't stop people from doing that activity, and you know, we need to be part of a movement now that tells the government, you've gone beyond the bounds of what's necessary to fight terrorism, and we need to make sure that you're not going after political dissent activity.
That was Kit Gage of the First Amendment Foundation, and in New York, I'm Robert Knight.
A top aide to Canadian Prime Minister Jean Chrétien resigned today over the controversy caused by her private comment last week that U.S. President George W. Bush was a, quote, moron. François Ducrot, who initially offered to quit but was kept on by Chrétien, is leaving the prime minister's office after all. In a letter of resignation to Chrétien, Ducrot wrote, "It was very apparent to me that the controversy will make it impossible for me to do my job. I would therefore like to leave my position as director of communications immediately." Chrétien accepted the resignation this time, responding in a letter, "In your almost 4 years as a director of communications, you have served the government as a whole and me personally with extraordinary skill and dedication." The comment made in a discussion with the radio reporter last week at the NATO summit in Prague has dominated Canadian media, with daily newspaper and broadcast stories on the aftermath that has included calls for her resignation by opposition politicians. Democratic Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney called in to Pacifica radio station WPFW in Washington this morning regarding what she perceives as a lack of leadership within the Democratic Party and her deep concern for the international perception of George W. Bush as a moron.
You know, it's just sad that we would have government by charade. I look at the pictures of our president, and the most recent furor in Canada came as a result of one of the Canadian aides calling our president a moron. Now, I mean, how can we be the leader of the free world, the leader of the world, and there's a picture floating around of the president looking through binoculars, and he's got the lens cap on. And I'll never forget the picture of the president sitting with the Pope, and he's actually reading his statement to the Pope, as opposed to just having a free-flowing conversation with the Pope. And this person is the leader of our country and the leader of the world. How in the world did we get in such a predicament where people are calling our president a moron? But the Democratic Party, sadly, as we look around at what's happening now, where hundreds of thousands of people are taking to the streets against the war, this impending war in Iraq, where are the Democrats? When we talk about the plight of the veterans today, and the fact that a quarter of all of our veterans are homeless, sleeping on the streets, where are the Democrats? When we talk about the sad fact that the veterans, the young men and women who were recruited to go and fight in World War II and the Korean War, and then who at the time of their recruitment were promised, you do 20 years, we'll give you health care for life. And guess what? Just recently, the United States government said, no, the recruiters didn't have the authority to make that promise, so we don't have to give you veterans health care for life, although you're suffering from Agent Orange, Gulf War syndrome, depleted uranium, post-traumatic stress syndrome, all of these things. And now we've got this president, who is called a moron by some, ready to send another generation of young men and women off to war to become veterans again. And those are the issues that the Democrats need to be talking about. But sadly, the age of dissent, the age of informed and critical analysis of the root causes of problems that affect our community and our people and our country, and sadly, opposition, loyal opposition, seems to me that those days are sadly coming to an end.
Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney came under attack herself for questioning what the president knew about the 911 attacks before they occurred. There was massive Republican voting during Georgia's Democratic primary that resulted in her losing her congressional seat. While despite the media's aseptic description of casualties of war as collateral damage and smart bombs which only destroy their designated target, Ralph Shonan and Maya Shone, host of Taking Aim on Pacifica Station WBAI in New York, remind us that war is not always as clean as it sounds.
The press and the media have talked about the war pending in Iraq in almost detached and clinical terms without any real affect about the enormity of the crime that is about to be committed, Maya. If you look at the report in The New Scientist, it describes how the Iraqi war could kill 500,000 people.
The study, Ralph, was done by MedAct. MedAct is an organization of British health professionals who are part of the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. It's a comprehensive analysis that looks at the devastation wrought by war, sanctions, and the consequences both during the war and afterward. Should a civil war break out? Should there be nuclear weapons used, or the conventional weapons, which today are actually tactical nuclear weapons using depleted uranium?
Well, they used such an enormous amount of depleted uranium, Maya, at the time of the Gulf War, that it resulted in an absolute epidemic of deformities, thalidomide-like birth deformities. And it's interesting and rather terrible, actually, when I'm just reading here a report about the effect of depleted uranium in Afghanistan. And the article in The New Scientist reports that the actual amount of depleted uranium unleashed on Afghanistan far exceeded that which was used in the Gulf War, in which 200,000 Iraqis were killed. And the report continues that this depleted uranium has already resulted in the same phenomenon in Afghanistan that has been reported now universally in Iraq, namely an epidemic of birth deformities, an epidemic of neurological destruction of individuals, which has now become a part of the clinical reports of every hospital and clinic in the country.
And this is, as well, there are the 80,000 U.S. and 15,000 Canadian and a large number of British soldiers who are suffering from Gulf War syndrome as a result of the use of depleted uranium just from their participation in the war in the Balkans and in Afghanistan. So what the MedAct has estimated, there will be 48,000 to 261,000 people killed as a direct result of conventional warfare. From civil war, you can have 375,000 people killed, and if nuclear attacks, up to 4 million people. Now, this doesn't deal with the long-term, the indirect health effects of the war. As you know, almost 1.5 million people have died in Iraq and been killed, murdered, as a result of the imposed sanctions after the Gulf War.
And it should be noted on that score about nuclear weapons, apart from tactical nuclear weapons, which are essentially what depleted uranium represent, that the U.S. government has stated that they are contemplating using nuclear-charged so-called bunker busters throughout Iraq during this next phase of the war. They're going to have something like 60 days of saturation bombing. The devastation is unimaginable. At least 500,000 people now are anticipated to die. This is a war crime of huge proportions, And it's time to tell the truth about this. I think it's a question of treason at the top. We have war criminals in the White House, and the people of Iraq, the people of the region, no less than in our country, are going to be the victims of them.
This is Maya Schoen.
And Ralph Schoenman.
The British House of Commons met yesterday and weighed in on the UN Security Council Resolution 1441. The debate was heated at times, with British Foreign Secretary Jack Straw presiding. Concern ranged from Israeli compliance with previous UN resolutions to the possibility of military action.
The consideration is obviously being given about going to war with Iraq, a similar consideration being given to going to war with Israel, because they too have weapons of mass destruction. They too are daily breaking UN resolutions. They too are invading another country, and they too has got a leader in Sharon who's a state terrorist.
I will come to the point that my honourable friend seeks to make, which is about the proper and full enforcement of all United Nations Security Council resolutions. And we support the proper and full enforcement of all resolutions, including 242, 338, 1397, 1402 in respect to the Middle East. But I also say to him that those resolutions impose obligations not just on the State of Israel, but on the Palestinian Authority and on the other Arab states.
As I understand it, the only grounds on which an individual member state could take military action against Iraq would be under the right to self-defence or in taking humanitarian action. I cannot see that such situation applies to this country. Therefore, on what basis could action be taken without a specific UN Security Council resolution?
Well, I say to my honourable friend that the United Nations Charter of International Law is not that precise. I've already said what our intentions are. But I also say to her that exactly, she will say it's about humanitarian actions, but exactly this issue arose in 1998 in respect of Kosovo. That was the issue. Could there be military action against what we now know to be a brutal dictator, Milosevic, in the absence of a clear United Nations Security Council resolution? And the answer was, and the judgment was, that the international community was able to take that, and that has never been challenged. And I, however, placed huge faith in the Security Council. So far, that has been entirely reciprocated. We have to continue to do so. But in order to sustain the authority of the United Nations, we have to reserve the position. If we get to a situation where a consensus within the Security Council is not possible, that had we not taken that reservation in 1998, no military action against Milosevic would have been possible in respect of Kosovo, and that tyrannical dictator would still be ruining the lives of millions of people in the Balkans.
The Foreign Secretary said a moment ago that the UK government had a preference that there be a second resolution. But I would ask the Foreign Secretary, does he therefore disagree with the statements of the Leader of the House on BBC Radio 4 on Friday last, when the Leader of the House said that a second resolution would be needed to authorise military action if Iraq defaults? Is the Leader of the House wrong? Was he not representing official UK government policy?
Mr Deputy Speaker, attentive though I am to the remarks of my rival friend, the Leader of the House, I'm sorry that I missed that particular interview, although my honourable friend, his deputy, says that wasn't what he says, and I'll ask my right honourable friend, the Secretary of State, to send for the record, and we'll come back to it. Now I'll give way to my honourable friend.
I'm very grateful to the Foreign Secretary, not just for giving way, but for his willingness to respond to members' concerns on this issue. I'd like to ask him the other side of the coin. In the event that the inspectors report that they are getting full cooperation and that we do see Iraq moving towards removal of the weapons of mass destruction, does he agree that it is then extremely unlikely that the question of military action would arise, and even that at the end of the tunnel we can give Iraq some prospect of the lifting of sanctions?
Yes, I do. And there it is, a pathway to peace. The words would not come if Iraq had properly complied with the resolution, and nonetheless one of us had to come to this House to explain why, notwithstanding that, we were going to take military action. I mean, the circumstances simply would not arise. We couldn't do it, the Cabinet couldn't do it, the armed forces couldn't do it. And that is a settled view of the international community.
After several hours, the House of Commons agreed to support the UN Security Council resolution. George W. Bush's top security advisor, Dr. Richard Perle, recently caused consternation and shock when he stated that a clean bill of health by UN Chief Weapons Inspector Hans Blix would not halt an American attack on Iraq. Yesterday, when the British House of Commons met to discuss the UN Resolution 1441, former British Defense Minister and Labour Party member Peter Kilfoyle, who waited for 5 hours to have his say on the floor of the House of Commons, but did not, he has this response to Dr. Perle's comments.
I felt as though it was a case of somebody saying, well, you know, regardless of right or wrong in this and international law, we'll go ahead and do what we please. So I was very concerned, and I have to say that the same view is shared, obviously, by members of the administration in the United Kingdom as well. They seem to take the same line as Richard Perle on this.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of reaction has there been in the Parliament with regard to this position on the part of Richard Perle and the Bush administration and perhaps the Tony Blair administration?
32 members of the governing party rebelled against the party, and i.e. the Labour government's party, and voted against them, including myself.
How large is the party? 32 votes out of how many?
That's 32 votes out of about, I think, something like maybe 370 or so.
And so what exactly was the proposal that you were voting on or against?
Well, that proposal was to ask that not only should, if there was any material breach of UN Resolution 1441 by Iraq, that it would go back to the United Nations. And certainly before British troops were committed, that we would have a debate upon the use of British troops in the British Parliament. We don't have a War Powers Act like you do in America. So, in effect, the Prime Minister of the day can do what the hell that he or she wants in terms of disposing of British troops without any regard of what the elected parliamentarians think.
And so it sounds like on the basis of that vote last night, 32 to roughly 370, yes, that Prime Minister Tony Blair will be able to dispatch British troops whenever he feels it's necessary.
Well, no, it's not quite that simple, because the peculiarity of our system, the main resolution that was before us, I would have voted for, and everybody in effect voted for, because it recognized that Iraq does have to follow the UN Resolution 1441. But we would all sign up for it because we all agree that we can't allow Saddam Hussein to play politics. It's a question of the legality of the way in which you try and address these issues.
Would you say, Mr. Kilfoyle, that these figures, 32 to 370-ish, represent the broad public view on this issue across Britain?
No, we're talking about 10% of the Parliamentary Labour Party here, which is the governing party. But there are other smaller parties who take a similar view. What you do have is the two major parties are the Labour Party, which forms the government, and the Conservative Party. They're generally agreed. There's no doubt about that at the highest level. I do think, however, that as in the assurances that were given in the course of the debate have led many people to believe that the spirit as well as the substance of the UN Resolution 1441 is being followed. The danger would be, as and when there was to be military action taken without a reference back to the UN, then there would be a far, far bigger split. Polls that have been taken across the country reflect consistently a vast majority of people opposed to unilateralism or bilateralism in Iraq. That's been confirmed in poll after poll.
In an article that I'm reading, it says that Dr. Perle told MPs, and this is a direct quote, "I cannot see how Hans Blix can state more than he can know. All he can know is the results of his own investigations, and that does not prove Saddam does not have weapons of mass destruction." What's your reaction to that?
Again, I think it's a case of going to play with a stacked deck. Dr. Perle went on to say that, as far as he was concerned, that there would be people who could provide verbal evidence that Saddam has weapons of mass destruction. Now, I have to say, and I did say to Dr. Pearl on the occasion, that I find this extremely odd. You will always find dissident people in any nation at any time prepared to say these things. Whether that is true or false is neither here nor there. It is not, in any sense, credible evidence of what the realities are on the ground. I think, ironically, both the governments of the United States and the United Kingdom are well aware of what Saddam does and doesn't have, mainly because it was British and American companies that sold these things to him in the first place. But whether that will satisfy international opinion, or in the case of the United Kingdom, British domestic opinion, is another matter.
And there are reports surfacing now that seem to indicate that the U.S. is deliberately planning to provoke Saddam Hussein into some sort of a situation where it could attack justifiably.
Well, it wouldn't take an awful great deal to provoke an attack on Iraq. I think we have to ask ourselves whether a number of things on this, whether in fact there is a need for that military attack and the form that it would most probably take, which would without doubt include a great deal of bombing, which is of its nature indiscriminate, despite all the talk about smart weapons. But also the backlash that would occur if a transparently spurious set of reasons were contrived in order to facilitate an attack on Iraq. I think it will worsen the real danger that is faced in the Western world, that of Al-Qaeda terrorists and their like, which is far more immediate than any threat from Saddam Hussein and his Republican Guard in Baghdad.
Parliament member Peter Kilfoyle, any final thoughts on your part?
I think it's just so sad for the peoples of the United States and the United Kingdom that they're being led down an ideologically driven road which doesn't serve the national interests of either the United States or the United Kingdom. It may suit the worldview of those who are in charge of our respective countries, but it's got nothing to do with the well-being of the people themselves. If we wanted to do that, we'd concentrate on the more immediate threat of terrorism worldwide. And despicable though Saddam may be, he's not part of that.
Do you give any credence to the reports that link the oil connection to the Bush White House?
I'm quite sure that all, if you like, geopolitical thinkers would look at future energy supplies. There's nothing absolutely outrageous in that. It's a question of how you go about securing their safety and stability. And ironically, I believe that if it is the case that this is partly inspired by oil interests, it will do far more to destabilize matters in the Middle East and worsen the supply of oil than anything else is guaranteed to do, if for no other reason than it will unify Arabic and Islamic opinion against the West.
British Parliament Labour Party member Peter Kilfoyle. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced by Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias, and our engineer is Granger Helvey. We had production assistance from Adil Hamad of KPFA, Andrew Seltzer, and Tom Gomez. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. Special thanks also to our consulting producers Larry Binsky and Sam Husseini. Copies of this program can be ordered from the Pacifica Radio Archives by visiting the website at PacificaArchives.org or calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. You can send us your feedback at Pacifica's Peace Watch at Pacifica.org. That's Peace Watch at Pacifica.org. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Thank you for listening.